This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ranchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. It's been an exciting and an interesting week overall. In case some of you haven't noticed, we're back to wearing masks, except this time we're only wearing the masks outside. So good thing you didn't throw out those masks, the N95s and KN95s that you've had, because many people, though we haven't seen that much need for it here in the Hartford area, certainly in New York City, masks were back, cancellations were back in terms of sporting events and anything outdoors, and they were back to classes online. So it's the Canadian wildfire season, and it's something that I never thought about, and especially with the wildfires in Quebec. We're going to talk more about the health risks related to these wildfires later in the program. But my guest today, who I'm going to have, you know, one of the things that's great about this show now and the way we do it is we can get guests in from all over the country, all over the world. And today is one of those days where we have a nationally recognized guest. It's Cardinal Sidney Hines, M.D. Sid and I have been friends for years. He is a neurologist. He is a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point. And he has a common link with all of us because he went to the University of Connecticut for medical school and then went back into the military and served an illustrious career both in the field and in the war zone and in medical research. So we're going to chat with Colonel Hines later on in the program. I really want to touch on his experience in athletics. He is now the deputy medical director for the NFLPA, as well as the chief health equity officer. So we're going to talk about a variety of topics with him that I know you will find important. This day in medicine, June 10th, 1735, Dr. John Morgan was co-founder of the medical faculty at the University of Pennsylvania in 1765. So again, it speaks back to the things we have learned in the past, and the point of medical education in the United States having evolved from that point in time, and the fact that our forefathers had a clear understanding of the importance of medical education and public health. And it's a good reminder for all of us. As I mentioned, this week I was supposed to be in Denver, Colorado with Colonel Hines at the NFL Players Association, the Mackey White Conference. And I was prepared to get out there, get on a plane on Wednesday morning when I developed a case of vertigo, something I had never had before. And it's interesting because so many of the things on this program I learn from my patients, questions they have, listeners, and I guess my own personal experience in this case, because I had never really experienced vertigo. So I thought it was worth mentioning because, interestingly enough, in talking with Sid Hines, there was someone else at the meeting who developed a case of vertigo. So it's interesting because we often see it with virus and other infections. So vertigo, first of all, you have to get the definition down. And often we refer to it as dizziness, right? Patients, because that's probably the most descriptive term, but vertigo itself is a false sense of motion or spinning. Now, people pay a lot of money to induce that same sense of vertigo. So the same sense of illness and symptom that I had, people go to amusement parks and want to be spun around so badly that they develop vertigo. One of my pet peeves at athletic events is the dizzy bat contest. That is ridiculous, okay? Especially when they ask older people to do it. For those of you unfamiliar who haven't been to an athletic event lately, usually we have a lot of in-between inning entertainment, right? So they have someone look around, put their head on a baseball bat and spin themselves around, and then they have to run maybe 25 yards in a race. And everybody gets a laugh out of watching them stagger around. Nothing funny about it. And in fact, you can, after coming off of a ride, or if you're doing the dizzy bat contest, if you're older, you can have permanence of that vertigo. Because what you're doing is you're upsetting the inner ear. So in the inner ear, if you could think of a level that a carpenter uses, right, with that little air bubble in there. So you could tell if you're dipping to one side or the other based on the movement of that air bubble. It's the same thing in our inner ear, except the air bubble flows along these cells we call hair cells. They are fine nerve cells in the inner ear. So your brain detects the motion and then coordinates with your body to adjust appropriately. What we do is we try to fool that system by spinning around, making ourselves dizzy, and therefore there's a lag between the actual motion and your sense of motion, and that's vertigo. So basically, it's an unsteadiness or loss of balance. Now, some of the ways we see it, as I said, dizzy bat contest is like motion sickness, right? You're trying to create motion sickness. Someone who's in a car gets motion sick again. It's because of the visual stimuli not coordinating with the body and its sense of motion. Among the more common reasons, probably the reason I had it, was a viral inflammation of the inner ear. So although that bubble is moving, those nerve cells have in some way become inflamed, and there's a delay in how they detect how I was moving or how a person moves. And usually that's a self-limited issue. Now, you could also see it from medication, right? I think, again, many people who might be taking a sedative medication of some type or other medication may experience vertigo or, again, this false sense of motion. So, again, it's important to note. It's also important to note, one of the things I go over with a lot of patients is how you keep your balance. There are three factors in keeping your balance. One, vision. Two, your inner ear, as I mentioned already. And the sensory nerves in your feet. So people who have peripheral neuropathy, say it's related to diabetes or another cause, they have in some way impaired the sensory nerves in their feet. And those nerves are what detect pressure. Right? When you shift from side to side, you're feeling pressure. So you basically need at least two of those three things to keep your balance, either your vision, inner ear, or the sensory nerves. So that's why if someone, for example, has affected their sensory nerves, right, they could still stand still and keep their balance. But if you ask them to close their eyes or walk into a dark room, suddenly they're going to feel like they're going to fall over and will fall over. So, again, you need to keep that in mind when you're doing that. If you do have an abnormality such as that, especially with sensory nerves, it's important to have a well-lit room. So if you're getting up to go to the restroom at night or walking in a dark theater, be careful, because you may fall over. So I often tell patients to make sure they have these small night lights plugged into a socket somewhere to help give them some light and some guidance. Also, if you're going to be, for example, at a party, an evening party that's in a backyard where you may be on an uneven surface, may be worth bringing a cane or some other assistive device. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back. I want to talk a little bit more about the health risks associated with the wildfire smoke and things that we need to do to protect ourselves. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to have my guest, Colonel Sidney Hines, MD, who is the Chief Health Equity Officer for the National Football League Players Association and has so many other titles, but we really want to get into a discussion with him about brain injury, whether it be from wartime or athletes. And we want to talk about health equity. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And this week, we really learned a lot about the health risks of wildfires. You know, air pollution itself isn't something I don't think I'd ever heard about until I was young, and probably in the 70s, living in New York, we heard a lot about air pollution and started to see more and more of it. And obviously, it's a problem that's grown in many cities throughout the world, especially those where there are no restrictions on automobiles and things such as that that pollute the air. So we have seen this, but wildfires are something we hear about, what we, you know, we associate with being on the West Coast and California. So we're really just hearing about Canadian wildfire season, which is rampant and especially close by here in Quebec. So it's important, first of all, that we all understand that this is a problem. It's not just a Canadian problem, right? Let's understand that we live in a globe. It's their problem. No, their problem becomes our problem because it's a world problem from that standpoint. So we have to really understand that. And we have to understand that the reason we're seeing things like this, along with floods and dramatic changes in the climate, is because there is a change in the environment and global warming. But in dealing with the particular problem we're dealing with, first of all, we've been hearing a lot about the air quality index, something I've heard about but not really paid much attention to until this week. So the air quality index is based on measuring key air pollutants, and there are six of those. There's carbon monoxide, lead, ground-level ozone, nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, and sulfur dioxide. They measure the concentrations of those in the air and come up with an index. Now, a good index is about 50. What we're dealing with is a level of concern when that number gets to about 200. That's when you start having a discussion of, are we going to limit activities outdoors? Now, you have to understand that we were seeing levels in New York of over 400 this week. So those are dramatic rises in this air quality index. Tuesday night, I was at the Yard Goats game. The Yankees were in town, and you know, there was discussion of where are we going with this. I think the highest it reached was 170, but our AA affiliate in Scranton had to cancel their game, as did the New York Yankees playing in the Bronx. So again, this air quality index is really what we need to pay attention to. Now, what is it? What is the actual problem? And that is that with a wildfire, it's a little different. Remember, I gave you all those elements, carbon monoxide, lead, nitrogen, but it's the particulate matter in wildfires that becomes of greatest concern. Why? Because these small particles contain whatever that wood that those trees were subjected to. So that includes pesticides, insecticides, whatever we may have put in the earth or on those trees is now burned and is flowing through the air. So there is the element of the actual irritant coming into the lungs, as well as what that irritant carries with us. So it enters the lungs, but then it gets into your bloodstream. And that's where we develop more problems. So the susceptible groups, as always, are the elderly, people with chronic conditions, and especially people with pulmonary conditions. But what I didn't fully grasp was how much it impacts people who have heart conditions and people who have neurologic conditions like strokes. Because that particular matter, that particulate, those particles, when they get in the bloodstream, they will trigger a reaction causing your blood to become what we call hypercoagulable, meaning your blood will start clotting early and clumping. And when it does that, it's going to clog arteries, whether they be in the heart, the lungs, wherever they are. So the question always is, all right, what are we going to do? Well, obviously, stay indoors as much as you can. And also, make sure your air conditioning, your heating system have appropriate filters that have been changed periodically. You have to get that service. Those filters are key because you're still taking air in from the outside. But you have to make sure that as it goes through your system, that it is appropriately filtered. Obviously, not exercising outdoors, limiting your exposure outdoors. But the other issue that has come up is masks. So we started to see people wearing masks again. And the question comes up is, how effective are masks? And indeed, they are very effective, especially the N95 masks that we had used in the past for COVID, because they are specially made to block particulate matter. Once again, cloth masks, bandanas may provide some help with respect to larger particles, but those small particles that we're most concerned about that get into your bloodstream, you really need a good mask, like an N95. So when those numbers are that high, where we feel that it is unsafe, but you have to go outside, you should be wearing one of those masks. Once again, the irony of previously we had no masks outside, but when we stepped indoors, we wore a mask during COVID. Well, now the environment outside is the more dangerous and presents the biggest threat to us. So with that, we tend to put a mask on outside. We're going to keep watching this topic as best we can. A couple of quick topics I did want to touch on were, one of them is 9.2 million Americans are now reported as skipping doses of their prescription drugs to save money. I don't have to tell you how crazy this whole thing is that medication has become so expensive, prescription medication that people need. We're not talking about the fancy schmancy medications that are ridiculously expensive when they first come out on the market. We're talking about the basics here. The basics to control blood pressure that you need to control heart disease and heart rhythm, and people can't afford them. That's just an outright disgrace. So with that, I have to urge people, please don't do this. I see it all the time. I see it in people who are on seizure medications, anticonvulsant medications. You know, they start to skip doses because it might be too expensive for them to get. And they end up having a grand mal seizure, taking a giant step backward, putting their lives in jeopardy, and certainly their driving privileges and other activities they'd like to do. So please don't skip your medication. And if you are an elected official out there, get to work on this, okay? That's what we pay you to do. That's why we elected you. Keep people safe. And that's a big part of keeping people safe. So with that, we're going to take a short break now. And then we're going to be back with my guest who will be calling in, Dr. Sidney Hines. He is a retired colonel in the United States Army, a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point, and also a graduate here of the University of Connecticut, where he went to medical school, now specializes in neurology and nuclear medicine. And he's going to share a lot of his thoughts and a lot of questions we've had about brain injury in wartime and brain injury in athletics. If you need to reach me, you could get me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. If you wish to reach me, either live on today's program or during the week, the best way to get to me is through info@alessimd.com. And I'm always happy to take your questions and answer your questions as they come up. With that, I want to get to my guest today. My guest today is Colonel Sidney Hines, M.D. Sid is a retired colonel from the United States Army. He is a graduate of the United States Military Academy, graduate of the University of Connecticut Medical School, and he has spent his years in the military working a great deal with troops who have had brain injury, and he is now in his retirement taking everything he has learned and applying it more to the civilian population with athletes. Sid, welcome to the show.
Anthony, Tony, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with you all and all your listeners.
So let's start. Let's talk a little bit about your career. First of all, you know, just being at the United States Military Academy, and was it after that that you decided to go to medical school?
My folks will tell a story about a buddy of mine playing in the yard and, someone getting hurt, and that, my passion was to make sure that they got care. So they thought they knew right from the start. But I would say it was about in middle school, high school, that I thought that I'd want to be a physician. You know, there are a number of, of friends of the family. I didn't have anybody in my own family that was a physician, but got me interested. And one of the reasons why I went to West Point was that they had just opened up pre-med as an option. And I think it was only about a year or two into it. But it made it, that much more attractive.
Did you leave the military then to come to medical school at UConn, or?
Well, what I did was I had an obligation. You know, when you go to West Point, sure. At that time, you had, 5-year obligation to serve in the military. And luckily, as I was graduating, the branch of Medical Service Corps had opened up. And I thought, hey, that would be a terrific place to maybe solidify. So I did pre-med at West Point, but then I was in the Army for as a lieutenant for 4 years, and during the first Gulf War, as a medical platoon leader, as a moved on to XO of a Ford Sport Medical Company, and by the end of it, I was commander of a Ford Sport Medical Company. So, had a break in school, but I applied when I got back from the first Gulf War to medical school and got into University of Connecticut, and of the schools that I, went to or was offered invitations to interview, UConn was by far, the best school and most attractive to attend. So I chose UConn.
So you went on to decide to do neurology and nuclear medicine. How did you join those two things together?
Maybe happenstance, but after neurology residency, and then, you know, when I was in residency, certainly MRI spec was coming on board to help with the diagnosis of neurologic diseases. But I served at Landstuhl immediately after residency and was a staff neurologist and then chief of neurology. I was thinking about, well, I'd really like to do a fellowship. And at that time, a friend of mine had been studying or had left neurology and gone to nuclear medicine and was telling me about the, you know, how advantageous it was because of knowing the physiology and pathophysiology of all of medicine, but you could, you know, focus on the, you know, physiologic imaging of the nervous system. And that was very attractive. So I, after 4 years in Germany at Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, I went back to Walter Reed National, well, back then it was Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and decided to do and completed a nuclear medicine fellowship.
So,
and to tie it all together, it was funny.
That's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah, at that point, you know, the post 9/11 conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan had been going on, and huge influx of service members with mild traumatic brain injuries. And I had seen a lot of them at the beginning of the war come through Landstuhl, but then this need, well, how do we better treat and diagnose traumatic brain injuries, especially mild traumatic brain injuries? And so, you know, PET, SPECT, you know, SPECT, what more established, especially perfusion imaging, but PET-CT with F-18 fluorodeoxyglucose, FDG, I won't say it was in its infancy, but, you know, was not being used as a bread-and-butter clinical tool for concussion. So we married up with some of the neuroradiologists and physical medicine rehab physicians, and we started looking at neuroimaging modalities for TBI.
So let's get right to it. So, you know, you spent a lot of time looking at injuries in the military, brain injury in the military. And as many of the listeners should know, it's a real spectrum of injury. You've already mentioned mild traumatic brain injury, obviously more severe penetrating trauma on the other end of the spectrum. What have we learned? I mean, we've had a lot to work with now with the military, and how do we join that? How do we make that bridge over to athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's been my experience that, you know, when you talk to emergency medicine physicians, sports medicine docs, and primary care physicians who are on the front lines of concussions, sport concussions, mild traumatic brain injuries, you know, they're not hammering, you know, the table, pounding the table, looking for tools. You know, they feel good. I mean, that's their bread and butter. But when you look at it clinically, but there's nothing. We're still reaching for the objective tools. So when you think about the gamut of traumatic brain injury, mild, moderate, severe, penetrating, you know, most people, especially with tools we have, CT, don't necessarily have a difficulty diagnosing a moderate to severe traumatic brain injury. It's the concussions, mild traumatic brain injuries, and in the military, those are interchangeable. You know, it's finding those tools. And then I think the biggest thing or the biggest gap is the detection. So back in 2010, the Department of Defense decided to move from a symptom-based diagnosis to more a scenario. So you had to, you know, have a good mechanism of injury, so a blunt or overpressure trauma that then would lead to either loss of consciousness, derangement of consciousness, or post-traumatic amnesia. So any one of those things would then get you a diagnosis of concussion, or at least an evaluation, and then utilizing a number of tools. So when I hear folks, and it's usually researchers, and you know I'm part of that pool, kind of use the superlative that we haven't learned anything, we don't have anything to bring to bear. That's not necessarily true. I mean, we're still looking for better ways to diagnose and treat, but we've come a long way of, you know, first establishing a standard which we can now improve upon. And in addition to that, while we don't have a lot of technology that's overcome the field, you know, TBI, especially concussion, is still a clinical diagnosis, but we do have some tools that are showing promise that have, over the past decade, have helped with or informed the diagnosis and management of TBI. More specifically, mild traumatic brain injury or concussion.
And I just wanted to clarify, when you talk about a pressure-type injury, you're talking about a blast injury to the brain, correct?
Correct. And if I'm talking, I sometimes refer to overpressure, but blast overpressure.
Can you talk a little bit about blast overpressure and how that affects the brain?
Yeah. I think it also has a severity. So you have an overpressure wave that affects the entirety of the body, and it gets turned into mechanical energy, and we're just really tapping into the surface of what that means and if there are distinct. So a number of neuropathologists, to include Dan Pearl and his group, have started to take a look at perhaps a difference between the pathology, the damage caused by overpressure versus the damage caused by, you know, blunt trauma. The thing that's hard to tease that out in a military population, if you look at blast, you can go from primary blast, which is just that overpressure wave, but it has degrees. You have the overpressure wave, but people usually hit the ground, hit a wall, have something hit them. There's also other effects of the explosive device that need to be accounted for. And so pure overpressure injury is difficult to find in a real-world solution, a real-world situation. And there's been a lot of work and research to try to tease those things out. And animal models that suggest, you know, certain mechanisms of injury. But we're still looking at the other thing that we are struggling with is that we don't have a dose response curve. And this is another tie-in back to nuclear medicine. We're well steeped with radiation in regards to, say, acute radiation syndrome, and we know that there are changes that occur within the body with exposure to radiation, but don't reach, or if they don't reach the threshold for acute radiation syndrome. So we can kind of measure a dose and response, and we don't fully have that for humans in regards to overpressure. Now, having said that, one of the other things that I like is that there's hope. And when you're taking care of a patient who's either been exposed to a blunt or overpressure, and it fits in the category of a mild traumatic brain injury or concussion, those patients seem to respond to the same type of treatment regimen that we would bring to bear in having them recover.
I just wanted to get into, since you brought that up a little bit here, the recent study, the DOD NCAA study, which is probably the largest study of its type, where we looked at mild traumatic brain injury in athletes and through the Department of Defense. What have we learned so far from that study?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we've learned is we've thrown out that everyone's going to get better within 7 days or 7 to 10 days. And we, through that very thoughtful and well done research, and, shout out to Tom McAllister, Mike McRae, and Steve Brolia for championing that, and all the NCAA DOD care researchers, that, the trajectory may be a little bit longer, and we're looking at it both in regards to symptoms, but perhaps also subtle findings on objective, tests. And I think one of the things that has also, come to light is, the use of some biomarkers. So when you think of Banyan and now Abbott's effort in having a point of care device to draw blood biomarkers or serum biomarkers is a big coup, and taking that from bedside into clinical trials and clinical utilization has been huge, which has culminated, not fully culminated, we're still working, but Grant Iverson and Noah Silverberg have put together a paper for the American Academy of Rehabilitation Medicine, and proposed a classification to help us better diagnose or classify traumatic brain injury.
Sid, where's the future? We talked a little bit about tools, and I wanted to get on this. Do you think the future is in blood biomarkers? Do you think it's in imaging? Do you think it's in electrophysiology, right? We had the L-MINDA equipment. I've done some work with that. We saw a lot of these instant EEG things. We've got people out there selling collars to tighten the blood vessels around your neck. Where's the future in this in terms of diagnosis and treatment?
I'm going to say yes.
Okay. All of the above? I didn't make that one of the options.
and I think, a very astute colleague, when I pose a similar question, what tools would you like to have in the emergency department to bring to bear on TBI? And I mentioned one, and then I mentioned the a couple others like you just did, and he said, yes, I want them all.
Yep.
And I think that's the absolute right answer, especially for right now. And going back again to radiation exposure, so in radiation exposure, we call it biodosimetry. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole host of tools that go from being very sensitive to being very specific. Now, the one nice thing about it right now is we have looking at dicentric cultured lymphocytes analyses as the gold standard. We don't really have a gold standard right now. People will, you know, argue against that and say, well, clinical diagnosis is the gold standard, but a gold standard test. And so, you know, you want to have all of these tools at your disposal. Right now, with our parlay into a lot of the biomarkers, fluid biomarkers, we are looking at them for identification, diagnosis, management, recovery, rehabilitation. You know, my thought is that this is going to have different biomarkers that will be best suited for different stages, from prevention, protection, all the way through to recovery and rehabilitation.
I think that's key and something I think we're all interested in. Sid, we're running out of time, and I didn't even get to your work in health equity. So that only means that I'm going to have you back on the show in the near future, so we could go over kind of the health equity in brain injury and sports and in our society. Sid, on behalf of all the listeners, I want to thank you for your time today, and more importantly, thank you for your service. What you have done has been great for all of us, and all the work that you have done with respect to brain injury and protecting soldiers and our military personnel. Sid, thanks again for doing this.
Tony, thank you for having me on board. In regards to my service, I feel very lucky and honored to have been able to do so, and I try to continue to give back. So I thank you for the shout-out, and I appreciate it. It means a lot.
Thank you. And many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Korsner, been on the board for us today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week on Healthy Rounds, it's going to be Father's Day next week, and so we're going to talk about men's health. We're going to have some folks on to talk about prostate cancer and other health features that affect men primarily. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.